Thank you, everybody. My name's Deborah and I'm an addict.
Hello, Deborah.
And I have sort of mixed feelings about doing this chair tonight. I was asked to do it about 7 or 8 months ago. I shared at a meeting in West Hampstead, and at the time I was going through what I thought was a challenging period in my recovery. My husband, who was also in recovery, was relapsing. And at that time, I still had great faith that things could be turned around. You know, that I'd seen this program work before, it had worked for both of us. I'd seen it work for lots of people. You know, I'd seen the miracles, and I was feeling kind of strong, you know, worried, obviously, but, you know, I kind of had faith and I had a lot of hope. What I didn't know then was that things were about to get so much worse. And the last 6 months of my life have been, you know, the very darkest in my recovery and indeed my life. And it has affected my recovery. It has affected my my attitude to the fellowship. It has turned my life upside down. And I'm very conscious when I do a chair that you have to give a positive message of recovery. You know, you do, because you know this stuff does work. You know, that is beyond argument. And I'm very conscious, particularly, you know, talking to kind of, I feel a special affinity for the women in the room, and I kind of want to say to them, listen, you know, you can do this, you can turn it around. And but equally, we have to be honest. We have to be honest about where we're at. So tonight, just bear with me, it's likely to be a slightly incoherent and rambling message, but I just will do my very best to just honestly share with you what my experience of recovery is. So it's 40 minutes, so I should waste a few of those minutes by boring you with my early years. And I was born into a fairly regular working class family in South London in 1965. I had two brothers. And, you know, I've heard of people who've had far worse childhoods than mine. However, it would be true to say that I was no stranger to fear. And fear was pretty much a constant in my early years. And I was the sort of child who would rather be anybody else doing anything else, anywhere else, than actually where I was. And so when I discovered drink at the age of 8, I thought, this is good, this works. It tastes disgusting, I feel sick, but the fear has gone. You know, the fear has gone. And that was at the age of 8, and it was, you know, I can still feel it today, you know. The drink goes down, you feel it warm your tummy, and you relax and you breathe, you know, and I sort of felt I could breathe and things weren't so scary anymore. And so the pattern was set very early for me that however you were feeling, there was something you could do that could change that. And something else happened. My grandmother came to live with us, and I used to have to share a bed with my nan, and God, she was a cow. And she was fucking vicious, my grandmother. And she made me a nervous wreck. She absolutely made me a nervous wreck. And at the age of 11, I started wetting the bed. And which, of course, that pleased her. all over her wincy at 90. And so, you know, this being the mid-1970s, they took me down the doctors and I was put on Valium. Because that's what you do. That's what you did with kids then. You know, that's what you did with anyone then. It was... And so again, you know, the message goes in. However upset you are, however hard things are, there is something you can take that will change it for the better. And then sort of 11, 12, you know, I was then kind of drinking quite heavily. My family were very social, they were social, you know, always down the pub, fancy dress parties, football dances, it never stopped. And because as kids we were kind of largely unsupervised, you know, I was that little minesweeper who would be going down the room, like, clearing up all the drinks. And you know, I was kind of throwing up from drink regularly from about the age of 11. And I was a regular pub drinker from about the age of 14. And I discovered drugs. I mean, in those days on our estate, I can remember I used to go around to Nick the Neck, he was called, because the only place left in his body where he could get a vein was in his neck. So he was known as Nick the Neck. And we'd go to this thing called Monday Club, and you'd go around to Nick the Neck's and jam for Monday Club, and there you'd buy your teenth, my little 16th of hash, you know, and that became my little treat on a Monday. I'd had that. So it was kind of, and it wasn't dark then. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't dark. And looking back, I can see that I had to always be doing something. But addiction has been explained to me best when someone said, it starts out as fun, and then it's fun with consequences, and then it's just consequences. But it was fun for quite a long time. You know, it was fun for quite a long time. Even though I would get wankered, I would get into all kinds of situations, I still managed to have fun. And so much of my drinking and using was about chasing that memory. You know, it was about trying to get that back, trying to get back to that place. When it was good, for that little brief window when it was good. And it's subtle to start with, isn't it? Because, you know, like most of us, I expect, you know, teens, late teens, early 20s, everybody's at it anyway. So you can hide in the crowd and you're just the same as everyone else. And I was, you know, I was kind of quite lucky as well. I was a lucky person. I got jobs. I landed on my feet. Things went my way. It was very easy to think, well, not doing me any harm, you know. And I also would have told you, you know, that actually I didn't really start getting into trouble until I was in my early 30s. And not so long ago, I found some diaries that I written when I lived in California in my early to mid 20s. And I went through them, and every single day I was saying, I'm getting stoned all the time. I'm getting pissed all the time. I'm doing drugs all the time. And yeah, before I'd read those stories, I'd have looked back on that time and said, oh, it was fantastic. I was so healthy. You know, so this kind of the lies we tell ourselves about the lives, even in recovery, you know, I had a bit of a false memory syndrome about what it was actually like. But, you know, again, I was getting away with it. Do you know what I mean? I was getting away with it. I was functioning. And, you know, the periods of fun were getting less and less. The periods of depression, which I'd actually had as my depression began as a child, were getting longer and longer. But it was a subtle thing for me. You know, I hear stories of people's using where, you know, that they start and within like a year they're shot away. You know, well, mine was definitely a slow burn, you know, and it got to, it was always the next thing that was going to sort me out, you know. Well, you know, when I published my first book, then I'll calm down. And that came and went and nothing changed. And when I get into the right relationship, then, you know, it'll all settle down. And that happened and nothing changed. And when I moved to the country, then I'll really settle down. That came and went, nothing changed. And finally, but when I have a baby, then I'll change. Well, I had a baby and it took off. You know, that I think it was for me the combination of the isolation, being with a small child, living in the middle of nowhere, and that was when my drinking took on a slightly sinister edge, I would say, when it kind of moved from just being sloppy and a bit unhappy into not so good, you know, not so good. I mean, stoned morning, noon and night. But hey, that's just dope. That doesn't count, right? So when I was about 18, when my son was about 18 months, I just kind of realised this is not how it should be. You know, here's this little boy that I love very much more than my own life. And yet I think nothing of putting him in the back of the car when I've got two bottles of wine inside me and driving for 5 miles across country to get two more. You know, I think nothing of leaving him on his own in his cart so I can go out and get more booze or pick up a bag of weed or whatever. But of course, on the outside, you know, it all kind of looked pretty good. You know, my husband at the time was a wonderful man. He was, he was a bit of a big hitter. And so, we had a nice house and my son was, I always kept him beautifully clean and well fed, and all his little clothes and baby grows were always immaculately ironed, and and the house was clean and the dinners were nice, and you just sort of like kind of just keep the surface in order, and meanwhile, you're kind of slowly you're just emptying out. And then he was about 18 months. My partner said to me for a while, listen, he'd already been married to one alcoholic, he knew the signs. He said, you've got a drinking problem. And of course, I denied it and said, well, you'd fucking drink if you lived with you. He'd leave cuttings from newspapers about how harmful marijuana was. And I'd quote another study that said something different. So eventually I did ring AA when my son was 18 months, and the lady picked up the phone and I said, I think I might be an alcoholic. And she said, well, you probably are, love. I thought, that's just fantastic. Instant diagnosis. She hasn't even seen me. And I went along to my first meeting, and there were really nice people there. And I thought, and I listened to what they had to say, and I thought, yeah. And stopped drinking for a month, and then I started. And that then started 6 years of me being in and out. I was a serial relapser. I'd get a month clean and drink and use again, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And I think one of the reasons was because by then, intellectually, I could happily admit that I was an alcoholic and an addict. I could admit that. But I think in my gut, in my innermost gut, on a very fundamental level, I still hadn't quite given up the fight. I still hadn't quite surrendered. I was still waiting for that, mythical time when I could, just have a few lines of coke at a party. And, whereas the truth is, if I went to a party and I thought someone had some coke, I'd fucking mug them. I can remember me standing there talking to people and, can tell by the way they were talking to me. I knew they had coke. And I couldn't concentrate on what they were saying. And eventually I just had to say, are you going to give me some of your coke or what? it was not... I wasn't smooth. So I just kind of couldn't do it. And then eventually in 2005, I had my last drink, and it ended not with a bang, but with a whimper. I'd come home with my son, who was at that time 7, from a children's party. It was 9:30 at night. I'd been there since 2, drinking champagne. It is Berkshire. I got home, and my husband looked at me and he said, you've done it again, haven't you? I was like, what? Because I was so belligerent when I'd been at it. And he said, you've driven with him in the car, haven't you? And it was such a quiet moment. And it wasn't so much that I felt I surrendered, but what I saw was the total loss of hope on that man's face. Mm-hmm. He was beaten. I might have not felt beaten, but he was completely beaten. I'd got his hopes up to, I'd raised his hopes to dash them again and again and again and again. And this guy just looked completely heartbroken. And something got through my defences, something about the quiet way in which he spoke to me. And he was a gentleman, through to the very end, this man behaved impeccably. And so I stopped, and I never had another drink. But you know, it wasn't so hard when you were smoking an eighth of weed a day, which I then did for the next 4 years. And you know, I just wouldn't have it that, you know, it was a proper drug. I just wouldn't have it that it was a proper drug at all. Despite the fact that I used to have to get up at 5:45 in the morning and like build a big one so I could be like proper wasted by the time I woke my son up to make his breakfast and get him to school. You know, and that would just go on from the minute I woke up to the minute I went to bed, from the minute I woke up to the minute I went to bed. And I'd been to a few NA meetings, but I didn't think I belonged there. Because, not because I thought, I'm not as bad as you, but because I felt like a bit of a fraud. You know, here were people that had serious drug problems, you know what I mean? They'd lost families, jobs, their children had been taken away from them, they'd been to prison, they were in all kinds of problems. And I was just a fucking bored housewife who smoked a bit of dope, you know? And so I felt embarrassed, actually was what I felt. I felt embarrassed. And like, well, what have I got to complain about? But what it took me a while to realise is it doesn't kind of matter what the substance is, it takes you to the same place. And I shared at an NA meeting once about how I felt that I was a fraud, and I was amazed at the generosity of the sharing back, and people said, look, you know what? You belong here. You belong in this place. It doesn't matter what you've done. Because at that point, I was hollow. Mm. You know, I was completely hollow, and I used to go through these awful things. It's like I used to get my dope mail order from this kind of white witch in Dorset who used to grow her own organic gear. I mean, honestly, and she's kind of like, you know, they're like the Waitrose. of the soft drug market. And so I'd get like, you know, I'd get about like half an ounce had come through the post and I'd start smoking it, and then I'd think, oh my god, I can't fucking do this anymore. And I would flush it down the toilet. That's a lot of money, right? I'd flush it down the toilet. Half an hour later, I'd be driving out to this place called Mandela House in Reading, right? It's a place called Mandela House. What a shithole. And you used to be able to, if you went behind the bins, there was a bloke there that was like knocking out eights for 20 quid. So, you know, I'd flush my beautifully prepared organic weed to go and buy some awful crap, you know, from the guy behind the bins in Mandela House. And that just happened, but I couldn't see it as insanity. You know, I could not see it as insanity. I was just someone who liked to smoke. But interesting, at this point I had, my circumstances had changed. I had split up with my son's father and I had met, I'd met a man in recovery, and we fell very much in love. And although my son's father was a very, 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 very good man who I adore and respect to this day, ours was not a happy life together. And I was 42 when I met my husband. You know, it took me a long time to find love. It did, you know, to find the right kind of love. And it was actually him who said, do you know what? He said, I did not go through all the hell to get fucking clean and sober just so I could pitch up with someone who's stoned all day. You know, I'm just not doing it. So, again, I kind of like, you know, against my better judgment, I went to an NA meeting but something just kind of clicked. I think timing is so much, isn't it? Timing, it's like, you know, someone needs to get you at that right moment when your defences are down, why did it work then and not all the other times? I don't know why then and not all the other times, you know? And I fucking hated it, you know what I mean? I used to sit in those meetings and cry, be angry, was cross that it had come to this, you know, humiliated. But, you know, slowly, I began to fashion a life without drugs. And it's quite a strange feeling to be in your 40s and figure out you don't know who you are, that you have no idea who you are, because you have spent your life wearing a succession of masks and playing a succession of roles in search of an identity. So, for example, it was a great surprise to me that to discover that actually I was quite shy and I didn't like going out, you know. The big groups of people frightened me, you know. I mean, when I was using, I used to slalom across the room. Work that room. And mostly see if I could empty their pockets and get any drugs out. You know, my fantasy of myself was of somebody in a fabulous frock with a glass of champagne being incredibly witty. The truth is, there was a quote from Ava Gardner, who was describing a Hollywood starlet, and she said, "A party isn't a party without a drunken bitch in a pool of tears in the corner." That was me. You know, I drink, I use, I cry. You know, I just cry. It just wasn't a good look. You know, I wasn't edgy and dangerous. You know, I was just fucking maudlin. You know. And you know what? It all had to kind of change. And I discovered actually that who I was somebody who just wanted to kind of fucking stay at home and watch Midsummer Murders. Do you know what I mean? That was it. That's who I really am. And I'm really happy in my house. You know, people talk about a life beyond your wildest dreams. Well, you know, when I was using, my wildest dreams were all to do with success, status, glamour, you know, a string of lovers, all that kind of stuff, you know, lovely clothes. And actually, what I discovered in recovery was that what my dreams consisted of was of being, you know, that slightly dull woman with her arms in the sink that was always there when my son came home from school. You know, that's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be the one who always had the washing going, who always had the bacon sandwiches going, who always, you know, because when my little boy, when he was little, he was frightened of me, you know. He was, because I was erratic. I was either kind of all over him, or I was snappy and irritable, and I was always trying to get away from him so I could go upstairs and do a line, have a joint, do it, just get away from him. And so he was a nervous little boy. And what started to happen in recovery was that my little boy started to relax, you know, and he started to trust me, and I was able to do those things for him. And I was able to be at all his matches, you know, take him to all his cricket matches, just take him everywhere and do everything for him. I mean, I didn't turn into Mary Poppins, you know what I mean? It was still like, fucking beat that up! But, you know, on the whole, my behaviour was steady, you know. I was always where I said I was going to be, always, you know. I was never late, I was always on time. And life was getting better and better and better. And 5 years ago, I got married, and we were very happy, very much in love, very hopeful for our future together. You know, we'd been in recovery long enough to kind of know the pitfalls. I guess we were both kind of coming into long-term recovery then, you could say. And we looked forward to kind of growing our lives together, I think. And we, you know, we did a kind of good job. We did a good job. He was a wonderful stepfather to my son, and he was a hard worker, you know. He was a provider, and we had this kind of 1950s style marriage where he paid for everything and I did everything, and it kind of worked, you know. And we were pretty happy. But several months after we married, my husband had a terrible accident. He was to do with an exploding bonfire, and he was carted off in the air ambulance to the burns unit in Odstock, where he was for about 3 weeks. He was very, very, very ill and nearly died. And while he was in the hospital, he was given huge amounts of opiate-based pain medication, which was necessary at the time. However, when they discharged him, they sent him home with I've honestly never seen one of these before in my life. It was a green, dark green NHS carrier bag full of drugs. Oromorph, Tramadol. I mean, you know, we could have killed ourselves there and then. It was just extraordinary. And he kind of admitted, he even said to the nurse once, he said, "Do you know what?" He said, "I'm taking this morphine." He said, "But I think actually I'm medicating anxiety and not pain." So she went, "Oh, okay, good." And then she came back with some benzos. "Yeah, this is what you want for your anxiety, love. Take this, you know." And so, I mean, really, in a way, hospitals, I mean, they're just magical places, right? I mean, you can tell them anything. And but we came home, but what that did, looking back, what that experience did is it released his addiction all over again. And although he managed to put down the drugs when he came out of hospital, a year later we discovered that he'd been spending loads of money. You know, we were in tens of thousands of pounds worth of debt. And he kind of disappeared into himself, you know. He never slept properly again. He was always anxious. You know, some, and a lot of this is to do with the accident, you know, a lot of that's to do with the accident. And he did seek professional help for it. But he never kind of quite got it. And then I think a couple of years ago, in fact, when I did that chair in West Hampstead earlier this year, I'd only just found out he'd admitted to taking something called dihydrocodeine that he'd got off the internet. I mean, seriously, like fucking Amazon Prime. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. And that he'd been taking the stuff. He told me he'd only been doing it for a couple of months. He told someone else he'd been doing it for a year. He told someone else he'd been doing it for 2 years. I don't know what the truth was, you know. And I was in bits, you know. He'd been kind of... I know I can't tell his story, but it impacts on my own so closely. You know, all the classic things, isolating... You know, he built this temple of lunacy in his study. He turned it into a recording studio and, like, you know, not one microphone but 50. You know? Really nuts. It was like something out of, like, Dr. No. It was just, it was mad. And he was just disappearing. This man I loved was disappearing. And he was still kind. He was still loving. He was still a good husband. He was a provider. He was a good stepfather. But his... You know, his pilot light was going out. I could see it. 5, 10. Anyway, things reached something of a crisis earlier this year. There was a terribly bad week, and it was a... Oh, shit, I'm having a hot flush, sorry. Oh, Christ. And things got very bad, and it began to affect my son. You know, my son had come home from university for Easter, and he saw my husband, and we were getting in the car to go back to university. He went, "Mum, what is wrong with Clive?" And I said, "He's taking drugs again, love." That boy, this boy's 6'5", right, 19, he cried so hard that by the time we got 5 miles down the road, he had a nosebleed. And, you know, I'd been going to Al-Anon by now for months, you know, and reading about codependency and trying to detach with love. And I was saying to people, what the fuck does that look like, detach with love? How do you do it? How do you fucking do it? I've read all the books, but, you know, what does it look like in real life? How do I manage this? And I couldn't, but, you know, seeing my son so upset, that did it. Then I thought, right, I fucking let go now, you know. And so I came back from Leeds. I said to my husband that this situation could not continue. I was going to go away for a few days and stay with a friend that we needed to calm down, but that I felt I could not continue in the marriage as it was. And this was on the Thursday night. I went away. Friday, I was in Bristol at a funeral, and I got a telephone call from the police and to tell me that my husband was dead and that he'd... he'd shot himself at the bottom of our garden. And, and that was 6 months ago. 6 months ago. And I just can't tell you what it's been like. I got angry with the fellowship because, you know, we didn't fucking help him, did it? You know, I got angry with individuals. If anyone's never read Living Clean, it's such a good book. It's incredible. It's so beautifully written. But there's a couple of paragraphs here that really kind of sum up where I've been recently. It says, the bottoms we hit in recovery can be frightening. We go through some dark times when we're in pain. It can be hard to reach out and easier to see differences. But even in the darkness, the process is still going on. When NA members say, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle, we're not just talking about the first one. Our lives are full of moments when we are faced with a difficult decision to grow or go. Many of us leave not when things are horrible, but when we have one more spiritual hump to get over. We lose our way again right before the miracle, sometimes again and again. The faith that leads us to build a successful life may not be sufficient to sustain that day after day. A new kind of surrender is necessary if we are to stay clean and keep growing. Spiritual growth can be bewildering, frightening, and very lonely. Some of us give up on the process at this crucial point when there is nothing left to blame or change but ourselves. When we are in crisis, we may try all kinds of escapes and excuses before we resort to the steps. We can be intolerant, angry, defensive, vengeful, guilty, and resentful, testing the patience and tolerance of those around us. The only way out is through. We must roll up our sleeves and get to work. These struggles often push us into the next phase of our recovery. We can come out stronger and healthier people for the experience if we are willing to do the work. And, you know, having gone through the last 6 months being angry, resentful, punishing, blah, 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 I'm thinking, you know, okay, distancing myself from the fellowship, not going to meetings, sitting in meetings silently cutting everybody off. I mean, just being vile, actually, just a vile, poisonous woman. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, where does this end, actually? Where does this end? This thing that feels so right to be doing, it ends with you fucking yourself up, you know, and then your son's got nobody. You know, is that where this is going to end? So, as you know, as heartbroken as I might feel, I have no choice but to re-engage with recovery, to reboot my recovery, to you know, to just get back in there as much as, you know, every fibre in my body is telling me, I don't want to do it, I just want to stay at home and be upset. You know, I've fucking got to do it. And so that's what I'm trying to do now. You know, it's been 6 months and the pain has been indescribable. But I haven't wanted to use. Now, how weird is that, mm-hmm. you know? But although, interestingly, we're such opportunists, aren't we, adults? One of the first things I thought after my husband died was, I could have a little dabble now, you know? And no one would blame me. They'd all understand. Oh, poor Debs. It took me a couple of days to work out that actually I didn't want to. I thought, this is so horrific. Can you imagine what it would be like if I stuck drinking drugs on top of this? I just don't want to do it. You know, I know however much this hurts, using will only make it 10 times worse, you know, and there is no alternative but to fucking walk through this pain. You know, that is no alternative. But I've been trying to kind of think about, you know, how have I changed? How has recovery changed me? And a thought struck me this afternoon. I've come here tonight with a friend, a very good friend, someone with whom I often disagree violently, some of whose opinions I think are on the wilder shores of reason, but I love him like a brother. You know, if anyone tried to hurt him, I would fucking kill them. You know, that's how I feel, visceral. It's like he's a family member. And when I was using, you could divide my relationships into lovers and rivals, you know? And now my relationships are brothers and sisters. Mm. And that is a huge change. It's a massive change for me. You know, me who spent all my life, like, looking for love in all the wrong places, you know? Now I don't go looking for love. I look at what's in front of me. I see the love that's in front of me. And I thank God that he brought those people into my life, you know? And I have real relationships these days, you know, real arguments, but, you know, real relationships, real honest relationships. And it's, I don't care what people look like or what they do or, you know, although I do like men with nice cars, I have to say. But, you know, I have become a kind of a genuine person in the sense that I'm no longer afraid to show you who I am. you know, whereas in my using days, I was terrified you might find out who I am. Because if you knew who I really was, you really wouldn't like me, you know. And my husband actually had a great quote about this. He used to say that, he said, I've spent my life spending money I haven't got, buying things I don't want to impress people I don't like. And I think that sums up the using life. And the life in recovery is, yes, it gets tough, but you know, the last 6 months has proved to me that if you stick close to the people in this program and you stay close, you can survive anything.
Yes.
So I'll leave it there.
Wow. Yes.